think anybody could have played those tunes better. I don't care what tune it was. If he approached it, if he decided to play it, you were going to hear something that was unbeatable.
Oh, absolutely. You know, the biggest, warmest, fattest sound on record in that day, and it still holds up in a very big way today when you listen to those records.
And he didn't play cliches. I love the way he plays the blues because he can play chorus of chorus without playing the phrases that almost every musician simply falls into.
His unmistakable sound filled the airwaves and record collections across the United States in the mid to late 1960s. Warm melodies and full chords, backed by lush arrangements, provided the soundtrack for millions of people's lives. Wes Montgomery achieved something few jazz musicians have: popular acceptance. I'm Nancy Wilson, and on this edition of Jazz Profiles, the life and music of Wes Montgomery.
I could easily be the first person to sell those records short, but I don't want to be. He's a wonderful player, and he's still playing on those things. Those records were successful for a reason. They weren't just some kind of empty records that were hyped into success.
Orrin Keepnews was the producer who recorded the other side of Wes Montgomery, his early straight-ahead jazz recordings for the Riverside label, the ones that firmly established Wes as one of the most inventive, distinctive jazz guitarists to come along since Charlie Christian.
When I was a kid, 13, 14, 15, around then, I brought home this Wes Montgomery album, So Much Guitar, and I just flipped.
Gary Giddens, music critic for The Village Voice and author of the book Visions of Jazz, The First Century.
Because it doesn't sound like any other guitar player in a way that Jimi Hendrix doesn't sound like anyone, or Django, or Christian.
His playing transcended the instrument.
Writer, guitarist, and former editor of Guitar Player magazine, Jim Ferguson.
Other jazz guitarists, you know they're playing the guitar, but Wes and his whole approach, the way he phrased, his sense of swing, you kind of lost a sense that he was playing the guitar. He played the guitar like a horn, for instance. He phrased like a horn player, and it just really caught people's imaginations. It was really different.
Different, yet influential. Just as every saxophonist since Charlie Parker has had to contend with the legacy he left behind, so have guitarists had to come to terms with Wes. His direct descendants include Pat Martino, George Benson, and the late Emily Remler.
I love Wes. I mean, for a while there, I had Wes's picture in my room. He was watching me practice, and I just copied him right off the record a lot of times. Try to get his time feel, which is the most superb time feel. To get Wes's good, happy type feeling, you have to be a certain type of person. You know, you can't be that fast, technical, guitar player, competitive thing. People tell me I sound like Wes or a lot like Wes, and I say thank you, I love you.
I'd have to say that he laid down some incredible rules for the guitar, one that's not easily forgotten.
Guitarist George Benson first heard Wes Montgomery on records when Benson was just a teenager in Pittsburgh.
Wes Montgomery had a gigantic effect on the music world that's still being felt today. When I think of him, I think about a man who was a most unlikely genius.
An influential, innovative musician who never learned to read music. That was just one of the apparent contradictions in a life full of them. Wes Montgomery was a forward-thinking jazz player who pushed the boundaries of his instrument, yet always considered himself a working musician whose job it was to please an audience and support his family. And as musically sophisticated as Wes the jazz player was, Wes the man was unassuming and almost naive, says his friend, cornetist Nat Adderley.
Wes was not an educated man, and he could not explain to any great degree how he was doing what he was doing. He just did it. And he was a very ordinary man in the ordinary sense of husband and father. People in the neighborhood all knew him. You know, it wasn't that he was some special person to him, but what he was doing was creating some amazing music that he did not, I don't believe he knew how amazing it was.
Despite travels across the country and overseas, in his heart, Wes never got far from Indianapolis, Indiana, where he was born John Leslie Montgomery on March 6, 1923. Wes was apparently a child's abbreviation of Leslie.
Now, this is the house where I met him, right here. 1102 North Persia. That's where he was. His mother lived there. His father lived in Columbus, Ohio.
Serene Woods is Wes Montgomery's widow. As she drives through Indianapolis, pointing out some of Wes's old haunts, she talks about a musical family, parents who sang in church.
It was a Blackmon's family. They were singers. And Wes's sister plays the piano sometimes, you know, in a church.
There were also four Montgomery brothers. The oldest was Thomas Jr., nicknamed June.
They all was musicians. His oldest brother died when he was about 18 because he had pneumonia in some way. I think he played the drums.
The youngest was Charles, nicknamed Buddy, a pianist, vibraphonist, and composer who went on to play with Miles Davis.
He stayed on the piano. They had his mother had a piano. And they played music all night. Wes on the guitar and Bud on the piano. I said, my goodness.
Then there was William, nicknamed Monk, a pioneer of the electric bass guitar. After their parents separated, Monk, Wes, and June moved to Columbus with their father. In a telephone interview just a few months before his death in 1982, Monk Montgomery remembered buying Wes his first instrument, a four-string tenor guitar, when Wes was about 12 years old.
I gave him the money to get it. He got a guitar out of a pawn shop. And I remember I let him have $13 when he bought his first guitar. And when he brought that guitar home, there was no doubt in my mind that what he was doing, in very early stages, it was good. You know, he's playing in tune, playing the right songs and changes. I remember when we had moved from Columbus back to home, in our hometown, Indianapolis, Wes used to go to the park and play. And he would be sitting over on in a part of the park with a little crowd around him, you know. Some of the kids would be dancing or whatever, and he'd be just playing his guitar away, you know. But hey, man, he was getting really good.
Wes actually began playing music before Monk and Buddy, and this contradicts one of the myths about Wes Montgomery, that he didn't start playing seriously until he was 20, when he got his first six-string electric guitar.
Well, you can do a lot on the tenor guitar. Tiny Grimes, for instance.
Writer Jim Ferguson.
So I think that point is overlooked a lot in Wes's development. Once he began to really focus on six-string guitar, you know, a lot of that rudimentary work that a lot of people can spend years on, he had already had out of the way.
But it was hearing electric guitar pioneer Charlie Christian on a Benny Goodman recording that inspired Wes Montgomery to become a jazz guitarist. The record was Solo Flight. In a 1963 interview, Wes told critic Ralph J. Gleason, "Charlie Christian, that cat tore everybody's head up. I never saw him in my life, but he said so much on records. I still hear it. He was it for me." Like so many guitarists before him and since, Wes Montgomery tried to copy Christian's solos note for note. He worked on them over and over. And when he felt he was good enough, he got a job at a local club. When it came his turn to solo, he played Christian, note for note. The late Monk Montgomery remembers hearing his younger brother practice.
I remember Wes was listening to Charlie Christian at the time. And Wes was doing those things. He could play fast, he could play in any key, he could play by himself, he didn't need anybody. Times at home, he'd be practicing, you could hear him in the night, you know. It just sounded great, but you could tell he was sharpening his playing. You know, he was sharpening his styles, the direction he wanted to go in.
Wes was completely self-taught, learning at home and on the bandstand. He began playing regularly with several Indianapolis groups. Then, in 1948, Wes landed a job with Lionel Hampton's band. Montgomery toured with Hampton for 2 years. One of their jobs landed them in North Carolina, where a young student heard them, a kid named Creed Taylor, the same man who would later produce some of Wes's most popular recordings.
I was a freshman at Duke University, but I must admit I didn't get any impression about the unique musical quality that Wes had at that point. He didn't get much of a chance to solo. Lionel Hampton was such a showman, you know, spent most of the time dancing on his toms.
But Wes eventually got homesick and wound up back in Indianapolis. By this time, he had a growing family to support and got a succession of day jobs to help pay the bills. He worked as a welder, in a foundry, and for a local milk company. At night, he played music. He'd start the evening at the Turf Bar, a club on the west side of town near the Speedway, playing from 9 p.m. till 2 a.m. When that closed, he'd drive over to the Missile Room, an after-hour spot, where he had a trio with organist Mel Rhine.
Well, it was sort of a laid-back atmosphere. You know, they served coffee, barbecue, ribs, and all the musicians. When musicians came in town, that's where they would come by and hang out, you know. I remember Horace Silver coming by and parked his car in front of the place, full of instruments and everything. Somebody broke in and stole everything out. I remember Cannonball Adderley and some of the Count Basie band coming in. I came to work and all those people were in there, and you know, I kind of felt like going back home, but with Wes there, I felt, well, you know, I'm safe.
Wes Montgomery, Mel Rhine, and drummer Paul Parker playing Missile Blues, named for the After Hours Club, from Wes's first Riverside session. But that's still to come. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to a tribute to Wes Montgomery on NPR's Jazz Profiles. In the mid-1950s, Buddy and Monk Montgomery moved to California and formed the Master Sounds, a sort of West Coast version of the modern jazz quartet, featuring Buddy's vibes and Monk's electric bass. The group had a bit of a hit for Dick Bach's World Pacific label with its recording of Music from the King and I. Buddy remembers wanting to share the good fortune with his brother, who was still struggling back home.
As a family, we wanted to stay close. set a lookout for your brother kind of thing, you know. So no matter whether if he was down and we were up, he was up. If we were down and he was up, we were up. And I knew that Wes was sitting back in Indianapolis with all his talent, and it's just a shame not to be, you know, somebody not to be hearing him.
Monk Montgomery picks up the story.
I remember we had occasions where we would work with the Master Sounds, and we would bring Wes in on to a concert, just trying to get exposed for him, right? And I remember we came back to Chicago, and we had worked it out with Dick Bach that we want to do an album, not the Master Sounds. So we want to do a straight-ahead jazz album. Three brothers and five others. So it was the three of us, and we used five other guys. Freddie Hubbard was on that album, as a matter of fact. It was Freddie Hubbard's first album. But Buddy was playing vibes on the thing. And Buddy likes to write, and he wanted to hear his music with horns and the guitar. We made this album, but its charts were good. The guys were kind of had a chance to rehearse them, and we just ran through the charts. So Dick said, well, with us more time left in the studio, why don't we just play a couple of things? Just play them. So we said, okay, well, let's do some straight-ahead things with Wes without the horns. And all. When they finished, they said, well, let's give it some kind of name. So we'll call it Finger Picking. And when that was released, Dick Bach released a single on that one. It got more play than the album did.
Wes's reputation started to spread, but so far it was mostly musicians who were talking about the incredible jazz guitarist from Indianapolis. After a concert there with George Shearing, Nat Adderley says he and his brother Cannonball went to the Missile Room to hear Wes.
We were very anxious to finish the concert so we could go hear this great guitarist that we had still not heard. And when we went to hear him, he was everything that we had assumed it would be. It was fantastic. We heard one set, and we went out looking for a telephone because there was not a telephone in this little joint.
But they had to wait till they got back to New York, according to Riverside Records producer Orrin Keep News, to break the news about the phenomenon from Indianapolis.
Cannonball Adderley comes bursting into my office and announces to me that he has just heard this really great guitarist and makes the statement that we've got to get him for the label.
Prompted by the outpouring of enthusiasm, Keep News made arrangements to fly to Indianapolis, where he caught the first show of Wes's evening at the Turf Bar.
It was one of these bar band situations, and they worked inside an oval bar. So I got a seat at the bar quite close to where Wes was playing. And at that time, since this was many years ago, I still had my 20/20 eyesight. But that thumb blurred before my eye. It was moving that fast. I was an instant convert to Wes Montgomery. Listened to him through all of the sets of that evening, and then at the end of that time span as the sun rose over Indianapolis, as the sun rose over middle America, I whipped out a standard union contract form from my pocket and proceeded to sign him to the label.
Keep News had Wes in New York within 2 weeks. On October 5th, 1959, at the age of 36, Wes Montgomery recorded the first full LP of his own, the Wes Montgomery Trio, a dynamic new sound. For it, Wes used his regular Indianapolis group, Mel Rhine playing the Hammond B3 organ and Paul Parker playing drums. Sessions for Riverside Records followed in a little more than 4 years. 10 albums of his own, recordings that took the legend from Indianapolis to an audience around the world. Wes's follow-up to his debut was called, appropriately, The Incredible Jazz Guitar of Wes Montgomery. Downbeat Magazine's New Star Award in 1960. And with this album, listeners really got a chance to hear what set Wes apart. First, there was the thumb. Wes did not use a pick, choosing instead to pluck the strings with his right-hand thumb, says guitarist Lee Ritenour, who counts Montgomery as one of his biggest early influences.
What this did, it brought the flesh and the body and the soul right directly to the guitar. So he had this very warm approach. Also, what the thumb ended up doing for him, it sort of created this different kind of phrasing. When you use a guitar pick, there's sort of this natural tendency to play all downstrokes with the pick or down up. And rhythmically, that sort of locks you in, phrasing-wise, and Wes didn't have to go through that problem. Of course, he had other problems. You know, people with a pick can generally play faster, but it was amazing that he could do an up and down stroke with his thumb, and he had the ability to make his thumb go real fast.
Wes could make his thumb go fast for a reason, says George Benson, who got to know Montgomery over the years.
By him playing so long that way, he had developed a corn on his thumb. And his thumb was malformed also. His thumb was very different shaped. It was very, very round. He could actually bend his thumb back to touch his wrist. And when he played single line, it almost sounded like he was playing with a pick because it was so clear you couldn't imagine that he was actually using his thumb to play with it. And people who tried to do that could never come up with that sound.
Wes happened on his thumb playing almost by accident. In a 1968 interview for Detroit public television station WTVS, he said he started with a pick.
A pick seems to have more of a piercing sound, and it's sharper. And I like it for my amplifier to be on because I found out that when you practice without an amplifier for like 2 months, and then you use an amplifier, you hear more noise than you do notes. So I said, well, I'll break that habit, so I just use an amplifier all the time. But while doing that, I would go into the night practicing, but I forgot I was disturbing neighbors. So that was very shortly brought to my attention.
By his wife, Serene.
He would just want to play all night, and I said, man, would you please stop playing so I can get some sleep. And he said, well, how am I ever learning anything if I don't practice, Rena? I said, man, why don't you turn your music down or something? He said, well, what I do is I put my pick down and play with my thumb. I don't care how you do it, just so, because I want to sleep.
So then I thought, well, I have to cut down some kind of way, but I had my amplifier really cut down. If I cut down much more, I might as well not use it. So then I set the pick on top of the amplifier and made it much of a rounder sound, softer. I said, well, I'll use that until I get where I can play, and then I'll use a pick. But I forgot you have to develop a pick. So then I wasn't trying to be one of the best anyway. I was just playing for my own amusement. So why go through all the trouble of developing a pick when I can play my thumb when I want to play?
Besides using his thumb, Wes got his full, warm sound by playing octaves. Writer Jim Ferguson explains.
You can play a phrase, for instance, as a series of single notes, and Wes was great at that. But in this octave approach, Wes could play the same phrase as playing two notes at the same time, an octave apart. It's also very difficult to do on the instrument. Guitarists had played in octaves before, Django Reinhardt, for instance. But Wes played them with such freedom and such fluidity and fluency. He played very complex lines with these octaves. You didn't hear the difficulty. It was really just astounding, a beautiful, fat type of sound, and became one of his trademarks.
Himself said he stumbled on this technique too.
Well, I was tuning up one day, and my guitar was always out of tune. Well, I thought it was because I had a bad guitar at that time. You know, I bought a Lemon, but even the new one, they just don't stay in tune. So they would be in tune maybe down at the low end, but up here, within this range, it would be out of tune. So I used to take the first string and the third string and go like that and find out how close they were together and which one goes out. They're not tuned up. So while doing that, I ran a scale. Accidentally, I said, oh, it's not too bad. And so then I put them together and ran the scale again. I said, well, I think I'll play a melody, you know, a line.
Despite his chance approach to innovation, Wes practiced hard. He told critic Ralph Gleason that working on octaves used to give him headaches. But work he did, developing a very deliberate approach to building a solo, says Lee Ritenour.
Usually he would start with single notes, halfway through the solo, switch to the octaves, and then finally finish it off with just an incredible flurry of 3 to 4 to 5 note type chordal soloing. And on the top note of the highest note that he would play on a chord, there was still this incredible melodic thrust going on. And by the time he got done with the solo was more memorable than the melody. And sometimes he was playing some great melodies too, you know. Thank you.
The record Wes Montgomery made for the Riverside label between 1959 and 1963 featured him playing with his own groups and his brothers, and paired him with Cannonball Adderley, Nat Adderley, George Shearing, Johnny Griffin, and Milt Jackson. But it was one record in particular that pointed to Wes's future. It was called Fusion, Wes Montgomery with Strings. Wasn't Wes's final session for Riverside, but a year later, the company went bankrupt. Wes's manager, John Levy, decided to accept an offer from Verve Records producer, Creed Taylor.
Well, the first deal was to get a record contract, a record deal going. And the other thing was to, you know, just establish him in the marketplace.
And producer Creed Taylor heard something in Wes's playing that gave him an idea for a plan that would do just that.
It was impossible for Wes to do anything that didn't swing, and he was very, very conscious of the melody. And so I thought that here's an instrumentalist who could really become big if he were put in the proper context and if the productions were carefully planned, and we went from there.
Wes's first recording for Taylor featured the guitarist with a large ensemble, arranged and conducted by Johnny Pate. It was still mostly a jazz record that opened with a hot version of Caravan. Wes's next recording for Verve marked a change in direction and set the mold, literally, for the rest of his career and those of a number of other musicians who would follow. Bumpin' matched Wes and a rhythm section with strings. Producer Creed Taylor and arranger Don Sobeski tried recording live, as Orrin Keepnews had done with the fusion session. But this time, Don Sobeski says something just wasn't working.
Well, we weren't getting good takes. It didn't have that buoyant feeling that we've come to associate with Wes, that nice natural feeling. It was all kind of artificial and sort of stiff. So we figured out that the best way to solve it was to start from scratch and bring him back into the studio with just his rhythm section, just the tunes, and maybe a loose structure, and then take that tape. And I go home and analyze it and figure out the best way to sort of amplify and raised to another standard of sort of polish what he had done on his own, rather than asking him to fit into a framework that was thrust upon him. And that's what we did for all the albums we did after that.
It came to be called the CTI sound, after the label Creed Taylor would found on leaving Verve. And it became a formula for recordings by Paul Desmond, Freddie Hubbard, and Hubert Laws. And it all started with Wes's 1965 record, Bumpin'. would make a couple of straight-ahead jazz records for Verve after Bumpin', including one of his best, an album that guitarist Jim Hall called Perfect, and Pat Metheny dubbed the greatest jazz guitar record ever. Smokin' at the Half Note was recorded at that New York club and at Rudy Van Gelder's New Jersey studio. It featured the Miles Davis rhythm section at the time, Wynton Kelly piano, Paul Chambers bass, and Jimmy Cobb drums. Wes Montgomery and the Wynton Kelly Trio, playing Wes's tune, 4/6, recorded in September of 1965. 2 months later, Wes went into the studio to lay down the tracks for his breakthrough recording. Producer Creed Taylor says Wes initially balked at recording an instrumental version of an R&B hit by Little Anthony and the Imperials.
I've never met anybody who was more relaxed and at home in any environment. He just had absolutely no pretension about him as a person. Only time he got a little uptight was when I gave him the Little Anthony and the Imperial 45 record. He says, "You must be out of yours."
Gone Out of My Head went gold and earned Wes a Grammy in 1966 for, no small irony here, best jazz performance by a soloist. Wes's brother Monk was playing in San Francisco when Going Out of My Head came out.
Every time I turned around, I was hearing this Going Out of My Head. We would be driving along in the car, no matter what hour it was, we were hearing Going Out of My Head. I was saying, wow. And I remember I spoke to Wes, it was, man, I don't understand it. So it's really, really, the thing is taking off. And he just couldn't believe it. I remember when they had set up a tour for him, because now he was really getting it. He came on the West Coast on a tour, and he worked the jazz workshop. And I rushed over to hear Wes at least get there in time for his last set. I couldn't get near the building. They were jammed up outside. I couldn't get near the building. And it was such a delight to stand out there on the sidewalk. They had the door open. You could hear it. It was really a good feeling. It was really a good feeling because he was on his way. There was no question about that. He was really on his way.
The recordings that followed took Wes in an even more commercial direction. Shorter tunes, less improvisation. Some musicians and critics have wondered how a player as original and creative as Wes could have been satisfied playing the pop tunes. One explanation may be Wes's devotion to his family. By this time, he had 7 kids. His widow, Serene, says she stood behind him whatever he wanted to do. She stood by him when he finally quit his day job to devote all of his energies to playing jazz. But she says she also told him he should play music people could have fun with.
I told him, listen, man, if you don't play something that women or the kids can pat their feet and their hands and dance by something, you're going to starve us to death. You're going to have to play something we like. Because he was playing music that I told him I wouldn't buy it. I said, because I don't understand, what are you doing? Now, blues, yeah, I liked it. I said, why don't you play a pretty blues? You know you can play pretty. He said, you mean to tell me this is what I'm going to have to play? I said, if you're going to feed me and my kids, you're going to have to stop playing the straight jazz. Every once in a while, I play something else. So that's what he did.
And producer Creed Taylor says nobody held a gun to Wes's head to force him to record pop tunes.
My philosophy has always been to put the artist in an environment, a framework that will enable him certainly to be comfortable and perform and sound like himself, but at the same time give him an entree into a wider audience. I've always felt that that was a responsibility.
But Gary Giddens says it was also Taylor's responsibility to ensure that all of Wes's artistry was documented, that he not only had an audience, but that he spoke to listeners with his full voice. Giddens maintains that for every two or three pop records Wes made, he should have been allowed to make a straight-ahead jazz record.
There's a moral here. You know, if you're dealing with a serious artist, you don't know how long you're going to have, and you can't afford, what is it, the last 3 years of his life, or there's virtually no serious documentation of the way he was playing in clubs.
And Wes was playing jazz in clubs and in concert halls up until his death. But there doesn't seem to be any recorded evidence of that after 1965. That year, he toured Europe with a quartet that included pianist Harold Mayburn. Here they are from a BBC TV show called Jazz 625. Gary Giddens remembers traveling from college in Iowa to a jazz festival in Kansas City that featured Wes, Nat and Cannonball Adderley, and Clark Terry.
When Wes came out, after Clark played an absolutely stunning set, a whole bunch of us, and a lot of people, believe it or not, started to get up to leave, figuring this is a good time to have lunch, because we just assumed he was going to be playing, you know, A Day in the Life and these one chorus numbers from the records. Well, I mean, from the first note, everybody just stopped and went back to their seats. He played one of the most dazzling sets I've ever heard anybody play in my life for an hour. He played blues, he played standards, he played chorus on chorus on chorus, like Coltrane. Nobody could believe it. And we figured, oh, well, he must be back. Wait until the next album. But the fact is he never recorded anything like that again.
Wes Montgomery died shortly after that concert. He had a sudden heart attack on June 15, 1968. He was 45 years old. Maybe the years on the road contributed to Wes Montgomery's untimely death, or the even longer years working multiple jobs to support his family. Maybe it was the stress of performing, the outwardly calm and smiling man who got headaches when he tried to push the bounds of his instrument. And maybe it was a combination of all of these things. Wes Montgomery changed the sound of jazz guitar. He remains one of its most influential practitioners, perhaps the most influential of all time. Yet, he also reached millions more as a sensitive and bluesy interpreter of pop songs. He made all of his records as a leader within the tragically short span of 9 years. Our tribute to Wes Montgomery was written and produced by Tom Cole. We'd like to offer a special thanks to Serene Woods and her husband, Perry. Thanks also to NPR member stations KQED in San Francisco, WYMS in Milwaukee, and WUSF in Tampa. We had engineering support from Vivian Stoll in New York and Ginger Bruner in Las Vegas. At our Los Angeles bureau, from Leo Del Aguila and Guy Napper. And in Washington, from Michael Schweppe and Bill McQuay. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens. The assistant producer is Madeline Smith. Our website coordinator is Bettina Owens. The vice president of NPR Cultural Programming is Murray Horwitz. To email us or get more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people make the arts part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and Gibson Guitars, featuring its historic collection, including the Wes Montgomery model and other collectible guitars. 800 for Gibson, or on the web at gibson.com. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.